production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. This week on our show, we're looking back to a conversation with IU food researcher Angela Babb, in part because there's something we want to follow up on, but we'll get to that later. She explains how milk ends up as a commodity surplus and why it might not make sense for it to play such a big role in the USDA's Thrifty Food Plan. Angela Babb explains what that is. But first, we hear from Harvest Public Media about difficulties with farmland transfers. And Chef D makes pizza. It's all just ahead on Earth Eats. The average age of American farmers is nearly 60 and trending older. If they don't plan for what happens with their land after they die, they won't have a say. Even so, passing property on is harder than it sounds. As Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck explains in the first of two stories about farmland transfer.
The Curry family farm is a little world of its own. Creeks and ponds and rolling hills in the middle of a pretty flat central Illinois. Each night, it's hog feeding time. Kim Curry said the property has been in the family since 1886, but she only moved there in 2008 when her father was dying of cancer. Now she says she can't keep up with it all.
We just don't have the energy to deal with the fencing.
Curry works for the state, comes home to her sister and niece, and they tend to the animals, which include hogs, chickens, cows, and 7 dogs. She maybe eats dinner by 8. She wants to sell about 80 acres of hilly grazing property, so she posted it this summer on a regional ag organization's website.
It really has potential with someone younger, more energy.
But Curry hasn't had any takers. She used that site because it was free and was the only place she knew about.
I didn't know to look.
There are other places in Illinois where you can advertise property for sale, like online and newspaper classifieds, but no large-scale state-run program like what's next door in Iowa. It's called AgLink, a database meant to link new farmers wanting to rent or buy land with tenured farmers wanting to provide those kinds of opportunities. And it's run by Iowa State University's Extension and Outreach. In a state where nearly a third of Iowa farmland owners are older than 75, David Baker with AgLink says he has requests from way more beginning farmers than older farmers.
So I would say 11 to 1, 12 to 1. I need more of the farm families to say, we have a legitimate business and we'd like to see it go on into the future. We'd like to support our communities by having this business here.
About 20 states have something similar to AgLink, some public, some private, and at least in Iowa, could use more interest from the older generation because fewer kids are staying on the farm. And if there isn't someone to pass the farm on to, it could become part of a larger operation, taking away opportunities for new farmers. Sally Worley is with Practical Farmers of Iowa, a group that promotes farm sustainability and healthy environments. She calls a major land transfer imminent.
The biological clock is ticking for a lot of those farmland owners.
And she's concerned about what that could mean for farm communities if farmland consolidation continues. Things like fewer people and slower economies. But she acknowledges it's hard to even think about retiring from farming.
You get so passionate about what you do that it's hard to pull back the reins and let somebody else lead.
And part of the problem is that people have to face death. Mervyn Roth encourages farmers not to wait for the inevitable. He's a farm manager in Macomb, Illinois, who helps keep a farm operation running when farmers die and pass on property to kids who don't farm. He says a plan can ensure a farm keeps running a certain way after death. Poor planning, on the other hand, can lead to arguments.
One family member wants to do one thing, one family member wants to do another, and so they call us in as a referee.
But the farmers who hold on until they die have an incentive to do so. Their property doesn't get taxed when they pass it down to their children, but those kids may already be in their 50s and 60s. Meanwhile, there are young farmers and beginning farmers watching and waiting for someone to give them an opportunity. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Listen next week to hear the second part of Harvest Public Media's series on farmland transfer. When it's cold outside, I love firing up the oven full blast to make pizza. It's never as hot as a true pizza oven, but it gets the job done. Chef Daniel Orr has a pizza recipe featuring my favorite cool weather greens.
We're gonna have some fun things to share. Today I wanted to make a autumn pizza or a focaccia. You could do either one that you'd like. Basically, the difference between a pizza and a focaccia is the thickness of the dough. And a focaccia is generally more of a bread-like thickness, and the pizza generally is a thin crust, especially in Italy, where they don't have deep dish Chicago pizza. We're going to use one of the ingredients I just picked out of my garden last night, and it's rainbow chard. And chard is a big leafy green vegetable with a thick stem that has a really kind of nice vegetal flavor to it, very earthy. And the rainbow chard is particularly beautiful. And you know, we always say on Earth Eats that you want to eat the colors of the rainbow to have a good diet. So we're definitely doing that with this dish. And we're going to throw some bacon on it. So, you know, that makes everything a little tasty. And we're going to start here with a standard pizza dough. Now, if you don't want to make your own dough, a lot of times you can buy a frozen ball of dough at the grocery store. And what I do is I roll it out with some local grits, which we get from Field of Agape, and they grind all of their cornmeal on a 100-year-old stone mill. And so we toss that with some flour, and then we roll the dough out with that. And then I'm going to just put a little bit of olive oil on it. Now, when you do the thin dough like I'm doing now, you can just kind of spread the olive oil over it. If you're doing more of a focaccia where it's a thick dough, what you want to do is take a fork and make some holes in your dough all over the place, so then that oil will kind of seep into those little crevices and give the dough a really nice olive oil flavor. And the better the olive oil, the better this is going to be. This is a time where you can break out your good olive oil, because you're not going to be bringing it up to a super high temperature, and it's really going to perfume the bread. So use an olive oil that'd be good enough to dip bread into. The next step I'm going to do is to sprinkle some garlic over that olive oil. Now, I start all of my pizzas at Farm Bloomington this way, and the reason is that oil creates a protective seal between the dough and the sauce that you're going to use, whether you use red sauce or today we're going to do a garlic cream sauce that I cooked the Swiss chard stems in. So I cut the Swiss chard stems into about inch long pieces and I cooked it down in a little garlic cream sauce, and you're just going to spread that over your dough. Now you want to leave about an inch parameter without any sauce. Next step, we're going to take some charred leaves. So you can see I'm using both the stems and the leaves. And I've blanched the leaves, which just means that I've boiled them quickly in salted water until they've cooked through. And then I've shocked them in a nice water bath. And that stops the cooking and keeps the kind of seals in the color and helps stop the nutrients from leaching out. Okay, and then you squeeze that out. And then I've tossed it with some roasted onions and some nice green Hungarian peppers out of my garden. Okay, and then finally we're going to top it with a little bit of cheese. And actually, we're going to throw some bacon on there. Okay, so the bacon I've already par-cooked, and so it's crispy. There won't be a whole lot of fat left in the bacon. And I'm just going to tear that into strips over the top of the pie. And, you know, this is a recipe you can really make your own with those late harvest tomatoes. You could throw in some late harvest zucchini. Sometimes you'll get some zucchini flowers. You could throw those on top of here. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to top it with some Parmesan cheese. Now, this is kind of the glue that's going to hold everything onto your pizza. So, you know, that's why you're going to use that on top of all your ingredients. So when it melts, it's going to hold everything onto the dough. So when you cut it, it's not just going to all fall off. And then I'm going to finish it up with my friend Judy Shad's goat cheese from Capriol Farm. And that's going to give it a nice, milky, rich flavor and texture. Okay.
You can't go wrong with two kinds of cheese.
Okay, now I'm just going to shake that, make sure that it's loose on my pizza palate, and then I'm going to take it over to the oven. Now, I'll throw it in my stone oven, and it's going to take about 7 minutes to cook. You can also cook pizzas in a lot of different ways. You don't just have to do it in a pizza oven. What I also did on the summer is I grilled pizzas. And what you do there is you take the pizza dough and you oil it slightly on both sides. And you mark the first side, get a little bit crispy. And then you take it off and you flip it over and you dress that grilled side with all of your ingredients. And then you return it to the grill on the ungrilled side and turn off the heat on one side and just let it cook on the grill. And just got to monitor, turn it every once in a while, a couple different ways. And it really adds this kind of charred, smoky flavor to the pizza. Turn that pizza every couple minutes so it cooks evenly on all the sides. And when it's done, we'll come back and give it a taste.
You can find this recipe and many more on our website, eartheats.org. You can also find us on Twitter, at EarthEats.
And so here is our charred pizza with local Mariah bacon and Judy Shad's goat cheese. I think you're going to love this pizza.
Oh, that looks fantastic. And so colorful, too. You're going to want to try this pizza, probably tonight. We have the recipe at eartheats.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Kate.
Do you remember earlier this year when we had a couple of conversations with Angela Babb?
Yeah, I do. She's a food researcher from Indiana University's Department of Geography.
Yeah, and first we talked with her about the history of the Farm Bill and how food stamps,
now known as SNAP,
got connected to it in the first place. And then the second part was on the focus of her research.
The Thrifty Food Plan.
Yep. And the Thrifty Food Plan is where the USDA looks at the amount of money that a household needs to buy food. That's how they allocate how much money goes to SNAP recipients.
And SNAP is run by the USDA?
Yes, along with other government nutrition programs.
But what is the USDA? What do they do?
Let's go ahead and let Angela Babb explain.
Sounds good.
The USDA is the largest, most diverse department out of the U.S. government. They are overseeing marketing support for farmers. They're overseeing rural development and nutrition assistance and forestry. The clearest conflict of interest is between the marketing of agricultural goods and the development of nutritional guidelines and nutritional assistance programs. Historically, those agricultural goods that we're producing are corn and soy and wheat. At the same time, the nutritional guidelines are directing people to eat the specialty crops, the fruits and vegetables and legumes that aren't supported financially by the Farm Bill. So it's pretty ironic telling folks in poverty to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables when those are more expensive than the cheap grains that have been processed into millions of different products at this point.
Right, which are in the boxes in the middle of the supermarket and are more affordable and, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the suggestion is to get the food stamp program or the nutrition assistance programs and the dietary guidelines out of the USDA and hand them over to the Department of Health and Human Services. Yeah, so that's the call, but the USDA has been reluctant to get rid of their part in the nutritional assistance programs because those have always been an outlet for the surplus commodities that they're supporting through the Farm Bill.
The lobbies or the parts of the USDA that have an interest in supporting corn, soy, wheat, these large-scale commodity crops that are being subsidized, want to hold on to SNAP because it's a way to move those commodities within the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah, SNAP and TFAP.
So, and what is TFAP?
So the Emergency Food Assistance Program is the direct line to the food banks and the commodity boxes that are then distributed to senior citizens and to Native American reservations. And under Trump's new proposal, to just about every household on SNAP. So that's, it seems less clear now that the food stamp program has changed so that people presumably have a choice on how to use their food stamps. But economically, when they get to the store, that choice is really limited because of the relative price of foods at the store. It's still those cheap processed corn and soy products that are the most affordable and most accessible to folks on SNAP.
What do you think would be a good next step in terms of reorganizing all of this? How would you fix the world, Angela Babb?
Well, that's a loaded question. I'll do my best. I mean, to be totally real with you, I would say we have to get out of the frame of food security and think about food sovereignty and the ability of farmers to have a real choice in what they're growing, to have foods valued not in their market price, but in, you know, their nutritional and their cultural values, and to have folks struggling in poverty to have a more dynamic safety net program. I personally study the Thrifty Food Plan, which is this model diet that underlies the SNAP allotment. So it determines how much people get in food stamps. And the calculation needs to be changed. It's not enough money for people to afford a really nutritious, culturally appropriate diet. So we need the safety net there. We need to, you know, have SNAP or something similar in place, but the program itself needs to change quite a bit. And I would be a proponent too of shifting the regulation of it over to the Health and Human Services Department. I think it's really important to recognize that there's plenty of food. The issue is not the availability of food. We currently produce more than twice what we need in this country. But what we're producing is not ecologically sustainable. It's not culturally appropriate for most Americans. And the way that we've prioritized cheap food and convenient food and driven down the value of food has terrible implications for folks in poverty expected to survive on that cheap processed food, to survive on the surplus or basically the waste of large agribusiness.
Can you say a little bit more about the cultural appropriateness or lack thereof?
Yeah, so one thing I find really alarming is in the Thrifty Food Plan that determines the budget that these, you know, SNAP households have to live on, there is an assumption that households are consuming over 3 cups of liquid milk every day. The reason for that is because of the way we've subsidized corn, we've effectively subsidized dairy. And now milk has become the cheapest form of protein, and it's been fortified with some vitamins. So there are roughly 1 in 4 Americans that are lactose intolerant. Globally, 60% of the population is lactose intolerant. It is not typical for folks to be able to digest lactose after the age of 2. But the dairy lobby has been very effective in maintaining those subsidies and maintaining their interests within the farm bill. And we expect folks, even the educational part of SNAP, the SNAP program, trains folks that are lactose intolerant to consume more and more milk to try to build a tolerance rather than respect the fact that people are lactose intolerant. They don't need or want to be drinking that surplus dairy. It's and frankly, it's racist too, when you think of, when you realize how people of color are disproportionately more likely to be lactose intolerant. Something like close to 100% of Native Americans, 90% of African Americans, 80 some percent of Asian Americans. Like I think 60% of Hispanic Americans. So it's really not culturally appropriate to be expecting these folks to, one, live on that much dairy when their bodies don't need it or want it, but also to survive on those processed foods high in sugar and salt that are leading to issues of, you know, diabetes and cardiovascular disease and hypertension, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. That's really fascinating to hear. about the dairy and the ways that, like, the actual diet itself that gets laid out is itself has racial implications. Mm. Is itself racist, I should say.
It really is. I mean, it's institutionalized racism, yet another form of it.
So, Alex, we ended that conversation last spring with me expressing my surprise at hearing that so many people of color are lactose intolerant. I wasn't aware that it was such a common condition at all.
And I hadn't realized that milk was part of the commodity surplus.
Me neither. I just thought it was corn and soybeans, maybe wheat.
Yeah. And we wanted to hear more from Angela Babb about the Thrifty Food Plan.
Yeah, I wanted to know what exactly is in the plan. And I also want to know how they determine it.
Well, you're in luck, Kate. Next week, we bring Angela back into the studio to give us more details about it. She also has some good stories about how hard it was to get her hands on the information.
Oh, interesting. I'm looking forward to that.
Me too.
Next week on Earth Eats. Until then, find links to more of these topics at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps out with the show, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Angela Babb. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. I produce the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world, offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.